remember the last time I was at an NFUS dinner. I'm aware of the fact that it was here in St Andrews, but beyond that, I can't remember for reasons that doubtless some of you will understand. Can I, first of all, in the few short months that I've had this job, place an appreciation on record my appreciation for the efforts of NFUS and Nigel in particular. It was something of a race as to whether my own private secretary or Nigel would find me first after I was appointed. I think I had only just found the office when I got the first message put in front of me, please phone Nigel Miller, and that has been an emerging theme ever since. It was observed at one point that in one particular week in November, I think I had seen more of Nigel than I had of my own children. A state of affairs I think that probably both parties found to be satisfactory. I'm especially pleased to be here in what is a momentous year for Scottish farmers and for the whole of Scotland. Looking back on 2013, it's fair to say that last year was a momentous year for Scottish farmers as well. We saw the culmination of the long, arduous CAP negotiations, 2.5 years in the making since the Commission released the first legislative proposals for consultation in June of 2011. It's been a long, tough journey with plenty of hard bargaining along the way, but we got there in the end. I'm well aware of the strength of feeling on the intra-UK CAP allocation. The government took the view that, given the disparity of payment mechanisms and farm structures across the UK, the fairest approach was to share the 1.6% cut evenly. In recognition of Scotland's circumstances, DEFRA has agreed to pursue flexibility on coupled payments and carry out a review of allocations when the transition from historic to area-based payments was underway. George Eustace will go into more detail on this, along with the steps that we are pursuing to address concerns in consultation with the NFUS. But I would like to reflect that there were a lot of very solid Scottish wins at the conclusion of the CAP negotiations, including much needed flexibility to address the issue of slipper farmers and support for new entrants, issues that I know matter to you. This would not have been possible without a concerted effort in Brussels by DEFRA ministers, Scottish Government ministers, and by the industry itself. I reflect that the present setup works best when we can all pull together, and I regret merely that we don't manage to do more of that. I'd like to focus on one central element, one that will affect Scottish farming for years to come, and ways about which we have not yet begun to think. This year, for the first time ever, Scotland will benefit from a CAP that fully respects the decision-making structures we have here. Negotiated by the UK government, this guarantees full autonomy for the Scottish Parliament and Scottish Government to apply the CAP as they and you see fit. Full autonomy to encourage new entrants into farming. Full autonomy to tackle the issue of slipper farmers, and full autonomy to take tough decisions over what funding mechanisms are best for Scotland's incredibly diverse environment. Our farmers and crofters are vital to sustaining production, maintaining our landscapes, and supporting our local communities. We have some of the finest arable land, vast amounts of beautiful, difficult, rough grazing land, and everything in between. With so much diversity of need within Scotland, it is right that decisions on agricultural policy are devolved in their entirety to the Scottish Parliament, allowing greater local accountability, greater differentiation of treatment. It's not easy to get the balance right. In fact, before coming here today, I confess I was tempted to make a few mischievous digs about Richard Lochhead's difficulties in dealing with some of his challenges, particularly on the challenge of rough grazing land in parts of constituencies like mine. But I respect the fact that those decisions are his to take, and I will leave it to others better placed than me to scrutinise them. The job isn't finished by any means. The Scottish farming community now needs to explore what this autonomy can offer and how to make this work for you. At Westminster, the government is also taking action that affects the wider economy with an impact on your livelihoods. The latest IMF forecast confirms that the UK is now the fastest growing major economy in Europe, outpacing our competitors like France and Germany. GDP figures have shown a sustained period of good news for the Scottish and UK economy, with the economy growing by 0.7% for the last quarter and 1.9% over 2013. The government's long-term economic plan is working. The economy is growing, the deficit is falling, and jobs are being created. And with a very substantial proportion of rural MPs in government, we want to address pressures facing our rural economy and the communities that support it. We're driving activity to improve and maintain vital services for rural communities, such as access to broadband and protecting the universal postal service. Last year, we have helped farmers get a better deal from the big supermarkets by introducing the groceries code adjudicator, Christine Tacon, to oversee the relationship between supermarkets and suppliers. The relationship has been imbalanced for too long, and we want to make sure that the adjudicator has teeth, ultimately to benefit producers at the start of the chain. High fuel prices have been a problem experienced more harshly in rural areas. For farmers, this is not just about your personal transportation, it has a material effect on your business. The larger the farm, the harder these costs will be felt. We introduced the first UK rural fuel duty rebate scheme, securing permission from the European Commission to cut fuel duty by 5 pence a litre, trailing this first in the islands. This has been well received, and last month we put in an application to the Commission to extend this to rural areas of the mainland as well. If this is successful, this will be extended to 17 areas across the UK, 12 of which are in Scotland. It would mean the UK was the first member state to have an inland rebate scheme of this kind, and we are putting a lot of effort into making that case. 2014 will bring more challenges as we implement the CAP and get the economy back on track. But I would now like to turn to the decision facing us as Scots in September of this year. Make no mistake, this is the most important political debate of our lifetimes. In 7 months, we will have the opportunity to cast our vote on the future of our country in a referendum on Scottish independence. We will take the most fundamental collective decision that a nation can ever be asked to take. Whether we stay part of the United Kingdom family or choose to go it alone. That is Scotland's choice. Nobody in Scotland can afford to ignore the vote's potential impact, and I firmly believe that everyone must ensure that they have the facts they need to make an informed choice. There are many questions to ask and answers to be given about the impact of such a permanent and irreversible step. You won't be surprised to hear that I believe that we are better off as part of the UK, a political union that has served us well for 300 years. This holds true for Scotland's rural communities just as much as it does for our towns and cities. And in some cases, the arguments are even stronger. Europe is the classic example. Unlike many audiences, I shouldn't need to persuade anyone in this room of how important our EU membership is. It is incredibly valuable to our economy across a range of sectors. And I don't need to explain how difficult European negotiations can be either. You are better acquainted than most with the machinations of Brussels and wranglings with our fellow member states. So let me be blunt. If we choose to become a new separate state, we choose to leave the United Kingdom. In doing so, we would need to reapply to become a member of the EU in our own right. That is a question of law. We set out the clear legal position in the first of our analysis papers. We also published our legal opinion backing it up. The EU is a treaty-based organisation, and the United Kingdom, not Scotland, is the contracting party to the treaties of the EU. The continuing UK, England, Wales and Northern Ireland, would be regarded as the same state as the existing UK, with the same international rights and obligations. Its EU membership would continue on existing terms. The nationalists denied this for a long time. They used to say that an independent Scotland would automatically be a member of the EU, that membership would be inherited. They used to say they had legal advice to back that up. But eventually, the truth was forced out of them, only after spending thousands of pounds of taxpayers' money, I might add. There was no legal advice. There is no automatic entry. The Scottish Government now grudgingly accept that negotiations would be required for EU membership. But they still fail to spell out the reality of that process. Rather than applying in the same way that every other new member has done under Article 49 of the Treaty of the European Union, seeking the unanimous support of the European Council, having membership approved through an accession treaty, and having the application ratified with the constitutional requirement of each existing member state. We are told by the Scottish Government in their white paper that Scotland could become a new member of the EU by the back door. The so-called Article 48 route is held up by the Scottish Government as a superhighway to EU membership. The fast track not only into the EU, but also on exactly the same rights and responsibilities that we currently enjoy as part of the UK. But in reality, this is a dead end. Article 48 has never been used to expand membership of the EU. There is no way round the law. A new state must apply. It would be no different for an independent Scotland. That is not to say that a new Scottish state could not or would not become an EU member. But let us remind them that membership, and critically the terms of membership, would have to be negotiated with 28 member states. And that is unavoidable, irrespective of which article is used. This isn't just the view of the government, this isn't just my view, it's the view of the President of the European Council and the President of the European Commission. It's a view expressed by some of those 28 member states with a veto that an independent Scotland would have to negotiate with, including Spain. Indeed, it is a sign of how important an issue it is for them that the Spanish Prime Minister Mariano Rajoy came out with his firm view in November last year. And it's the view of expert lawyers like Jean-Claude Piri, the former Director General of the EU Council's Legal Service, who gave evidence to Holyrood Committee that it would not be legally correct to try to use Article 48. So what could this actually mean for the CEP, for Scotland's single farm payments? First of all, there are no guarantees that securing EU membership would be seamless, nor that it could be completed within 18 months, as the Scottish Government claims. The Spanish Foreign Minister reinforced Spain's firm view again last week that Scotland would have to take her turn. No plan B has been put forward by the nationalists to explain what they would do if they hit obstacles in negotiations or failed to meet timescales. People in this room well know how long and protracted EU negotiations can be and the consequences of inaction and delay. You know the latest CAP deal was 2.5 years in the making. Membership negotiations for the most recent entrant, Croatia, took a decade. Now, it might be easier for Scotland to get all the necessary arrangements in place, but then again, it might not, particularly if we are trying to negotiate an exit from the UK at the same time. A host of experts have concluded that this would be a complex undertaking, and one that is not in the gift of the Scottish Government, or indeed the UK Government. It would depend on all 28 existing member states. And it goes without saying, in this room at least, that any gap in membership could be devastating. Secondly, there are no guarantees whatsoever over these terms of membership, including CAP payments. These would have to be renegotiated and approved by all 28 member states. Last month, the Foreign Office published its analysis of EU and international implications of independence. This analysis was clear that no matter how much goodwill existed towards a newly independent Scotland, the reality is that national governments would act in accordance with their own national interest. Indeed, they would have a duty to do so. The Scottish Government claims that Scotland would automatically be entitled to a windfall in CAP funding. This bold claim ignores facts and political reality. Ask yourself this. Why would other member states that have had to phase in common agricultural policy receipts over 10 years agree to an independent Scotland automatically receiving full payments from day one? Not just that, but according to the Scottish Government, reopening the CAP deal and agreeing to give Scottish farmers increased payments too. That would mean newly joined countries like Croatia accepting a deal that was never offered to them or their farmers. Under the Scottish Government's timetable, this would require all 28 member states to rip up the hard-fought EU budget ceilings agreed to 2020 and reduce their share of the budget in order to give Scotland more money. Again, I will leave it to George Eustace to set out the further financial analysis that's been done by the Treasury to cost the various scenarios. But to me, there is a gaping flaw in the nationalist argument. On currency, pensions, EU membership, in all cases, they rely on everybody else falling into line, looking the other way, bending the rules, all to suit us. In my experience, that is not the way our European colleagues tend to do things. It's not just about EU membership, though. Like every other business up and down the country, farmers would be affected by new administrative arrangements or controls on cross-border trade. They would be affected by uncertainty over our currency and pensions. With the drive to boost exports, cutting our extensive presence overseas, as the Scottish Government proposes, makes no sense at all. The UK global network represents Scotland worldwide, employing over 14,000 people in 267 embassies, high commissions and consulates in over 150 countries. Scottish businesses have an absolute right to representation by UK Trade and Investment's 169 offices in over 100 countries, complemented by support from Scottish Development International offices in 16 of them. The entire network is using their clout to protect our economic interests. Promoting British and Scottish branded food and drink internationally through the UKI's Great Campaign, fighting the case for producers in Europe during past crises, and putting pressure on the Japanese authorities to remove unfair trade discrimination against beef exports, defending Scotch whisky against counterfeits, discriminatory or excessive taxation, trade barriers and other restrictions. It's easier to unlock these deals with the draw of the larger UK economy, with our established representation and with our presence on the ground. This isn't just good for the distilleries, it's good for the supply chain, the farmers producing the malt barley. The Scottish Government proposes a much smaller network of 70 to 90 offices, scaling back Scotland's overseas representation by at least two-thirds. We need to keep up momentum in established and emerging markets. For an outward-looking nation, reducing overseas presence on this huge scale would be a backwards step. I've said elsewhere that while the Scottish Government want people to believe they have a vision, in fact what they proffer is a mirage. And like all mirages, the closer you get, the less real it becomes. Businesses throughout the country are taking a long, hard look at what this would mean for them. Last week, business found its voice. We heard publicly the supermarkets, the oil industry, the financiers, the pensions, specialists, manufacturing industry, even the fashion industry. Farmers should be no different. I urge you to weigh up the arguments affecting your business and examine the evidence, not just in CAP, but on currency, cross-border trade, exports. You will discover that the white paper is long in assertion and short in facts to back them up. To keep everything the same, it relies on everyone else. The English, the Welsh, the Irish and every other EU member state agreeing to do whatever suits Scotland. Yes, in some cases interests may well coincide, but not in all. Negotiation, by definition, requires compromise. We simply cannot afford to compromise on our currency, our unimpeded trade with the rest of the UK, the security of our banks, our pensions. One final point to touch on is that I am heartened that this debate is not about our Scottishness. That was a risk, and there will always be a few people out there who will try to present it in that way. But with one of the strongest national identities in the world as part of the UK, there is no doubt that we have proud Scots on both sides of this argument, something about which both the UK and Scottish governments can agree. As part of the UK, our national identity has flourished, our economy is stronger, and our societies are entirely integrated. Today, we have the best of both worlds, a devolved government that can develop policies tailored to Scottish circumstances while being part of a larger United Kingdom, which gives us greater stability, greater security, and an unrivalled platform on the world stage. We should aim for a stronger Scotland within the United Kingdom, with a positive future focused on jobs and growth. Make devolution work better, don't throw it away. The message I want to leave is that I'm not asking you to agree with everything the UK government says. We're a democracy, and it's right that the NFUS constantly pushes us to do more to represent your interests. But the vote in September this year will be irreversible. I'm asking you as individuals and as businesses to evaluate the hard evidence, risk versus reward, and to make an informed decision based on facts. A decision about what is best for you, for your family, and for Scotland. Thank you all very much.